Chapter 8. Apples or Indians? We have just seen how peoples of some regions began to cultivate wild plant species, a step with momentous, unforeseen consequences for their lifestyle and their descendants' place in history. Let us now return to our questions. Why did agriculture never arise independently in some fertile and highly suitable areas, such as California, Europe, temperate Australia, and sub-equatorial Africa? Why, among the areas where agriculture did arise independently, did it develop much earlier in some than in others? Two contrasting explanations suggest themselves: problems with the local people, or problems with the locally available wild plants. On the one hand, perhaps almost any well-watered temperate or tropical area of the globe offers enough species of wild plants suitable for domestication. In that case, the explanation for agriculture's failure to develop in some of those areas would lie with cultural characteristics of their peoples. On the other hand, perhaps at least some humans in any large area of the globe would have been receptive to the experimentation that led to domestication. Only the lack of suitable wild plants might then explain why food production did not evolve in some areas. As we shall see in the next chapter, the corresponding problem for domestication of big wild mammals proves easier to solve, because there are many fewer species of them than of plants. The world holds only about 148 species of large wild mammalian terrestrial herbivores or omnivores, the large mammals that could be considered candidates for domestication. Only a modest number of factors determines whether a mammal is suitable for domestication. It's thus straightforward to review a region's big mammals and to test whether the lack of mammal domestication in some regions was due to the unavailability of suitable wild species rather than to local peoples. That approach would be much more difficult to apply to plants because of the sheer number, 200,000, of species of wild-flowering plants, the plants that dominate vegetation on the land and that have furnished almost all of our crops. We can't possibly hope to examine all the wild plant species of even a circumscribed area like California and to assess how many of them would have been domesticable. But we shall now see how to get around that problem. When one hears that there are so many species of flowering plants, one's first reaction might be as follows. Surely, with all those wild plant species on Earth, any area with a sufficiently benign climate must have had more than enough species to provide plenty of candidates for crop development. But then reflect that the vast majority of wild plants are unsuitable for obvious reasons. They are woody, they produce no edible fruit, and their leaves and roots are also inedible. Of the 200,000 wild plant species, only a few thousand are eaten by humans, and just a few hundred of these have been more or less domesticated. Even of these several hundred crops, most provide minor supplements to our diet and would not by themselves have sufficed to support the rise of civilizations. A mere dozen species account for over 80% of the modern world's annual tonnage of all crops. Those dozen blockbusters are the cereals wheat, corn, rice, barley, and sorghum, the pulse soybean, the roots or tubers, potato, manioc, and sweet potato, the sugar sources, sugar cane and sugar beet, and the fruit banana. Cereal crops alone now account for more than half of the calories consumed by the world's human populations. With so few major crops in the world, all of them domesticated thousands of years ago, it's less surprising that many areas of the world had no wild native plants at all of outstanding potential. Our failure to domesticate even a single major new food plant in modern times suggests that ancient peoples really may have explored virtually all useful wild plants and domesticated all the ones worth domesticating. Yet some of the world's failures to domesticate wild plants remain hard to explain. The most flagrant cases concern plants that were domesticated in one area, but not in another. We can thus be sure that it was indeed possible to develop the wild plant into a useful crop, and we have to ask why that wild species was not domesticated in certain areas. A typical puzzling example comes from Africa. The important cereal sorghum was domesticated in Africa's Sahel zone, just south of the Sahara. It also occurs as a wild plant as far south as southern Africa, yet neither it nor any other plant was cultivated in southern Africa until the arrival of the whole crop package that Bantu farmers brought from Africa north of the equator 2,000 years ago. Why did the native peoples of southern Africa not domesticate sorghum for themselves? Equally puzzling is the failure of people to domesticate flax in its wild range in Western Europe and North Africa, or einkorn wheat in its wild range in the southern Balkans. Since these two plants were among the first eight crops of the Fertile Crescent, they were presumably among the most readily domesticated of all wild plants. They were adopted for cultivation in those areas of their wild range outside the Fertile Crescent as soon as they arrived with the whole package of food production from the Fertile Crescent. Why, then, had peoples of those outlying areas not already begun to grow them out of their own accord? Similarly, the four earliest domesticated fruits of the Fertile Crescent all had wild ranges stretching far beyond the eastern Mediterranean, where they appear to have been first domesticated. The olive, grape, and fig occurred west to Italy and Spain and northwest Africa, while the date palm extended to all of North Africa and Arabia. These four were evidently among the easiest to domesticate of all wild fruits. Why did peoples outside the Fertile Crescent fail to domesticate them and begin to grow them only when they had already been domesticated in the eastern Mediterranean and arrived thence as crops? Other striking examples involve wild species that were not domesticated in areas where food production never arose spontaneously, even though those wild species had close relatives domesticated elsewhere. For example, the olive Olea europaea was domesticated in the eastern Mediterranean. There are about 40 other species of olives in tropical and southern Africa, southern Asia, and eastern Australia, some of them closely related to Olea europaea, but none of them was ever domesticated. Similarly, while a wild apple species and a wild grape species were domesticated in Eurasia, there are many related wild apple and grape species in North America, some of which have in modern times been hybridized with the crops derived from their wild Eurasian counterparts in order to improve those crops. Why, then, didn't Native Americans domesticate those apparently useful apples and grapes themselves? One can go on and on with such examples, but there is a fatal flaw in this reasoning. Plant domestication is not a matter of hunter-gatherers domesticating a single plant and otherwise carrying on unchanged with their nomadic lifestyle. Suppose that North American wild apples really would have evolved into a terrific crop if only Indian hunter-gatherers had settled down and cultivated them. But nomadic hunter-gatherers would not throw over their traditional way of life, settle in villages, and start tending apple orchards unless many other domesticable wild plants and animals were available to make a sedentary food-producing existence competitive with a hunting-gathering existence. How, in short, do we assess the potential of an entire local flora for domestication? For those Native Americans who failed to domesticate North American apples, did the problem really lie with the Indians or with the apples? In order to answer this question, we shall now compare three regions that lie at opposite extremes among centers of independent domestication. As we have seen, one of them, the Fertile Crescent, was perhaps the earliest center of food production in the world, and the site of origin of several of the modern world's major crops and almost all of its major domesticated animals. The other two regions, New Guinea and the eastern United States, did domesticate local crops, but these crops were very few in variety. Only one of them gained worldwide importance, and the resulting food package failed to support extensive development of human technology and political organization as in the Fertile Crescent. In the light of this comparison, we shall ask, did the flora and environment of the Fertile Crescent have clear advantages over those of New Guinea and the eastern United States? One of the central facts of human history is the early importance of the part of Southwest Asia, known as the Fertile Crescent because of the crescent-like shape of its uplands. That area appears to have been the earliest site for a whole string of developments, including cities, writing, empires, and what we term, for better or worse, civilization. All those developments sprang, in turn, from the dense human populations, stored food surpluses, and feeding of non-farming specialists made possible by the rise of food production in the form of crop cultivation and animal husbandry. Food production was the first of those major innovations to appear in the Fertile Crescent. Hence, any attempt to understand the origins of the modern world must come to grips with the question why the Fertile Crescent's domesticated plants and animals gave it such a potent head start. Fortunately, the Fertile Crescent is by far the most intensively studied and best understood part of the globe as regards the rise of agriculture. For most crops domesticated in or near the Fertile Crescent, the wild plant ancestor has been identified. Its close relationship to the crop has been proven by genetic and chromosomal studies. Its wild geographic range is known. Its changes under domestication have been identified and are often understood at the level of single genes. Those changes can be observed in successive layers of the archaeological record, and the approximate place and time of domestication are known. I don't deny that other areas, notably China, also had advantages as early sites of domestication. But those advantages and the resulting development of crops can be specified in much more detail for the Fertile Crescent. One advantage of the Fertile Crescent is that it lies within a zone of so-called Mediterranean climate, a climate characterized by mild, wet winters and long, hot, dry summers. That climate selects for plant species able to survive the long dry season and to resume growth rapidly upon the return of the rains. Many Fertile Crescent plants, especially species of cereals and pulses, have adapted in a way that renders them useful to humans. They are annuals, meaning that the plant itself dries up and dies in the dry season. Within their mere 1 year of life, annual plants inevitably remain small herbs. Many of them instead put much of their energy into producing big seeds, which remain dormant during the dry season and are then ready to sprout when the rains come. Annual plants, therefore, waste little energy on making inedible wood or fibrous stems, like the body of trees and bushes. But many of the big seeds, notably those of the annual cereals and pulses, are edible by humans. They constitute 6 of the modern world's 12 major crops. In contrast, if you live near a forest and look out your window, the plant species that you see will tend to be trees and shrubs, most of whose body you cannot eat, and which put much less of their energy into edible seeds. Of course, some forest trees in areas of wet climate do produce big edible seeds, but these seeds are not adapted to surviving a long dry season and hence to long storage by humans. A second advantage of the Fertile Crescent flora is that the wild ancestors of many Fertile Crescent crops were already abundant and highly productive, occurring in large stands whose value must have been obvious to hunter-gatherers. Experimental studies in which botanists have collected seeds from such natural stands of wild cereals, much as hunter-gatherers must have been doing over 10,000 years ago, show that annual harvests of up to nearly a ton of seeds per hectare can be obtained, yielding 50 kilocalories of food energy for only 1 kilocalorie of work expended. By collecting huge quantities of wild cereals in a short time, when the seeds were ripe, and storing them for use as food through the rest of the year, some hunting-gathering peoples of the Fertile Crescent had already settled down in permanent villages even before they began to cultivate plants. Since Fertile Crescent cereals were so productive in the wild, few additional changes had to be made in them under cultivation. As we discussed in the preceding chapter, the principal changes, the breakdown of the natural systems of seed dispersal and of germination inhibition, evolved automatically and quickly, as soon as humans began to cultivate the seeds in fields. The wild ancestors of our wheat and barley crops look so similar to the crops themselves that the identity of the ancestor has never been in doubt. Because of this ease of domestication, big-seeded annuals were the first, or among the first, crops developed not only in the Fertile Crescent, but also in China and the Sahel. Contrast this quick evolution of wheat and barley with the story of corn, the leading cereal crop of the New World. Corn's probable ancestor, a wild plant known as teosinte, looks so different from corn in its seed and flower structures that even its role as ancestor has been hotly debated by botanists for a long time. Teosinte's value as food would not have impressed hunter-gatherers. It was less productive in the wild than wild wheat. It produced much less seed than did the corn eventually developed from it, and it enclosed its seeds in inedible hard coverings. For teosinte to become a useful crop, it had to undergo drastic changes in its reproductive biology, to increase greatly its investment in seeds, and to lose those rock-like coverings of its seeds. Archaeologists are still vigorously debating how many centuries or millennia of crop development in the Americas were required for ancient corn cobs to progress from a tiny size up to the size of a human thumb. But it seems clear that several thousand more years were then required for them to reach modern sizes. That contrast between the immediate virtues of wheat and barley and the difficulties posed by teosinte may have been a significant factor in the differing developments of New World and Eurasian human societies. A third advantage of the Fertile Crescent flora is that it includes a high percentage of hermaphroditic selfers, that is, plants that usually pollinate themselves, but that are occasionally cross-pollinated. Recall that most wild plants either are regularly cross-pollinated hermaphrodites or consist of separate male and female individuals that inevitably depend on another individual for pollination. Those facts of reproductive biology vexed early farmers because, as soon as they had located a productive mutant plant, its offspring would crossbreed with other plant individuals and thereby lose their inherited advantage. As a result, most crops belong to the small percentage of wild plants that either are hermaphrodites, usually pollinating themselves, or else reproduce without sex by propagating vegetatively, for example, by a root that genetically duplicates the parent plant. Thus, the high percentage of hermaphroditic selfers in the Fertile Crescent flora aided early farmers, because it meant that a high percentage of the wild flora had a reproductive biology convenient for humans. Selfers were also convenient for early farmers in that they occasionally did become cross-pollinated, thereby generating new varieties among which to select. That occasional cross-pollination occurred not only between individuals of the same species, but also between related species to produce interspecific hybrids. One such hybrid among Fertile Crescent selfers, bread wheat, became the most valuable crop in the modern world. Of the first 8 significant crops to have been domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, all were selfers. Of the 3 selfer cereals among them, einkorn wheat, emmer wheat, and barley, the wheats offered the additional advantage of a high protein content, 8-14%. In contrast, the most important cereal crops of Eastern Asia and of the New World, rice and corn, respectively, had a lower protein content that posed significant nutritional problems. Those were some of the advantages that the Fertile Crescent's flora afforded the first farmers. It included an unusually high percentage of wild plants suitable for domestication. However, the Mediterranean climate zone of the Fertile Crescent extends westward through much of southern Europe and northwestern Africa. There are also zones of similar Mediterranean climates in 4 other parts of the world: California, Chile, southwestern Australia, and South Africa. Yet those other Mediterranean zones not only failed to rival the Fertile Crescent as early sites of food production, they never gave rise to indigenous agriculture at all. What advantage did that particular Mediterranean zone of western Eurasia enjoy? It turns out that it, and especially its Fertile Crescent portion, possessed at least 5 advantages over other Mediterranean zones. First, Western Eurasia has by far the world's largest zone of Mediterranean climate. As a result, it has a high degree of wild plant and animal species, higher than in the comparatively tiny Mediterranean zones of southwestern Australia and Chile. Second, among Mediterranean zones, Western Eurasia experiences the greatest climatic variation from season to season and year to year. That variation favored the evolution among the flora of an especially high percentage of annual plants. The combination of these 2 factors, a high diversity of species and a high percentage of annuals, means that Western Eurasia's Mediterranean zone is the one with by far the highest diversity of annuals. The significance of that botanical wealth for humans is illustrated by the geographer Mark Blumler's studies of wild grass distributions. Among the world's thousands of wild grass species, Blumler tabulated the 56 with the largest seeds, the cream of nature's crop, the grass species with seeds at least 10 times heavier than the median grass species. Virtually all of them are native to Mediterranean zones or other seasonally dry environments. Furthermore, they are overwhelmingly concentrated in the Fertile Crescent or other parts of Western Eurasia's Mediterranean zone, which offered a huge selection to incipient farmers, about 32 of the world's 56 prize wild grasses. Specifically, barley and emmer wheat, the two earliest important crops of the Fertile Crescent, rank respectively 3rd and 13th in seed size among those top 56. In contrast, the Mediterranean zone of Chile offered only two of those species, California and Southern Africa just one each, and southwestern Australia none at all. That fact alone goes a long way toward explaining the course of human history. A third advantage of the Fertile Crescent's Mediterranean zone is that it provides a wide range of altitudes and topographies within a short distance. Its range of elevations from the lowest spot on Earth, the Dead Sea, to mountains of 18,000 feet near Tehran, ensures a corresponding variety of environments, hence a high diversity of the wild plants serving as potential ancestors of crops. Those mountains are in proximity to gentle lowlands with rivers, floodplains, and deserts suitable for irrigation agriculture. In contrast, the Mediterranean zones of southwestern Australia, and to a lesser degree of South Africa and Western Europe, offer a narrower range of altitudes, habitats, and topographies. The range of altitudes in the Fertile Crescent meant staggered harvest seasons. Plants at higher elevations produced seeds somewhat later than the plants at lower elevations. As a result, hunter-gatherers could move up a mountainside harvesting grain seeds as they matured, instead of being overwhelmed by a concentrated harvest season at a single altitude, where all grains matured simultaneously. When cultivation began, it was a simple matter for the first farmers to take the seeds of wild cereals growing on hillsides and dependent on unpredictable rains, and to plant those seeds in the damp valley bottoms, where they would grow reliably and be less dependent on rain. The Fertile Crescent's biological diversity over small distances contributed to a fourth advantage. Its wealth in ancestors not only of valuable crops, but also of domesticated big mammals. As we shall see, there were few or no wild mammal species suitable for domestication in the other Mediterranean zones of California, Chile, southwestern Australia, and South Africa. In contrast, four species of big mammals, the goat, sheep, pig, and cow, were domesticated very early in the Fertile Crescent, possibly earlier than any other animal except the dog anywhere else in the world. Those species remain today for the world's five most important domesticated mammals, Chapter 9. But their wild ancestors were commonest in slightly different parts of the Fertile Crescent, with the result that the four species were domesticated in different places. Sheep possibly in the central part, goats either in the eastern part at higher elevations, the Zagros Mountains of Iran, or in the southwestern part, the Levant, pigs in the north-central part, and cows in the western part, including Anatolia. Nevertheless, even though the areas of abundance of these four wild progenitors thus differed, all four lived in sufficiently close proximity that they were readily transferred after domestication from one part of the Fertile Crescent to another, and the whole region ended up with all four species. Agriculture was launched in the Fertile Crescent by the early domestication of eight crops, termed founder crops, because they founded agriculture in the region and possibly in the world. Those eight founders were the cereals, emmer wheat, einkorn wheat, and barley, the pulses, lentil, pea, chickpea, and bitter vetch, and the fiber crop, flax. Of these eight, only two, flax and barley, range in the wild at all, widely outside the Fertile Crescent and Anatolia. Two of the founders had very small ranges in the wild, chickpeas being confined to southeastern Turkey, and emmer wheat to the Fertile Crescent itself. Thus, agriculture could arise in the Fertile Crescent from domestication of locally available wild plants, without having to wait for the arrival of crops derived from wild plants domesticated elsewhere. Conversely, two of the eight founder crops could not have been domesticated anywhere in the world except in the Fertile Crescent, since they did not occur wild elsewhere. Thanks to this availability of suitable wild mammals and plants, early peoples of the Fertile Crescent could quickly assemble a potent and balanced biological package for intensive food production. That package comprised 3 cereals as the main carbohydrate sources, 4 pulses with 20 to 25% protein, and 4 domestic animals as the main protein sources, supplemented by the generous protein content of wheat, and flax as a source of fiber and oil, termed linseed oil. Flax seeds are about 40% oil. Eventually, thousands of years after the beginnings of animal domestication and food production, the animals also began to be used for milk, wool, plowing, and transport. Thus, the crops and animals of the Fertile Crescent's first farmers came to meet humanity's basic economic needs: carbohydrate, protein, fat, clothing, traction, and transport. A final advantage of early food production in the Fertile Crescent is that it may have faced less competition from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle than that in some other areas, including the Western Mediterranean. Southwest Asia has few large rivers and only a short coastline, providing relatively meager aquatic resources in the form of river and coastal fish and shellfish. One of the important mammal species hunted for meat, the gazelle, originally lived in huge herds, but was overexploited by the growing human population and reduced to low numbers. Thus, the food production package quickly became superior to the hunter-gatherer package. Sedentary villages based on cereals were already in existence before the rise of food production, and predisposed those hunter-gatherers to agriculture and herding. In the Fertile Crescent, the transition from hunting-gathering to food production took place relatively fast, as late as 9000 BC. People still had no crops and domestic animals, and were entirely dependent on wild foods. But by 6000 BC, some societies were almost completely dependent on crops and domestic animals. The situation in Mesoamerica contrasts strongly. That area provided only 2 domesticable animals, the turkey and the dog, whose meat yield was far lower than that of cows, sheep, goats, and pigs. And corn, Mesoamerica's staple grain, was, as I've already explained, difficult to domesticate and perhaps slow to develop. As a result, domestication may not have begun in Mesoamerica until around 3500 BC. The date remains very uncertain. Those first developments were undertaken by people who were still nomadic hunter-gatherers, and settled villages did not arise there until around 1500 BC. In all this discussion of the Fertile Crescent's advantages for the early rise of food production, we have not had to invoke any supposed advantages of Fertile Crescent peoples themselves. Indeed, I am unaware of anyone's even seriously suggesting any supposed distinctive biological features of the region's peoples that might have contributed to the potency of its food production package. Instead, we have seen that the many distinctive features of the Fertile Crescent's climate, environment, wild plants, and animals together provide a convincing explanation. Since the food production packages arising indigenously in New Guinea and in the eastern United States were considerably less potent, might the explanation there lie with the peoples of those areas? Before turning to those regions, however, we must consider 2 related questions arising in regard to any area of the world where food production never developed independently or else resulted in a less potent package. First, do hunter-gatherers and incipient farmers really know well all locally available wild species and their uses? Or might they have overlooked potential ancestors of valuable crops? Second, if they do know their local plants and animals, do they exploit that knowledge to domesticate the most useful available species? Or do cultural factors keep them from doing so? As regards the first question, an entire field of science, termed ethnobiology, studies people's knowledge of the wild plants and animals in their environment. Such studies have concentrated especially on the world's few surviving hunting-gathering peoples, and on farming peoples who still depend heavily on wild foods and natural products. The studies generally show that such peoples are walking encyclopedias of natural history, with individual names in their local language, for as many as 1,000 or more plant and animal species, and with detailed knowledge of those species' biological characteristics, distribution, and potential uses. As people become increasingly dependent on domesticated plants and animals, this traditional knowledge gradually loses its value and becomes lost, until one arrives at modern supermarket shoppers who could not distinguish a wild grass from a wild pulse. Here's a typical example. For the last 33 years, while conducting biological exploration in New Guinea, I have been spending my field time there constantly in the company of New Guineans who still use wild plants and animals extensively. One day, when my companions of the Foray tribe and I were starving in the jungle because another tribe was blocking our return to our supply base, a Foray man returned to camp with a large rucksack full of mushrooms he had found and started to roast them. Dinner at last. But then I had an unsettling thought. What if the mushrooms were poisonous? I patiently explained to my Foray companions that I had read about some mushrooms being poisonous, that I had heard of even expert American mushroom collectors dying because of the difficulty of distinguishing safe from dangerous mushrooms, and that although we were all hungry, it just wasn't worth the risk. At that point, my companions got angry and told me to shut up and listen while they explained some things to me. After I had been quizzing them for years about names of hundreds of trees and birds, how could I insult them by assuming they didn't have names for different mushrooms? Only Americans could be so stupid as to confuse poisonous mushrooms with safe ones. They went on to lecture me about the 29 types of edible mushroom species, each species name in the Foray language, and where in the forest one should look for it. This one, the tanti, grew on trees, and it was delicious and perfectly edible. Whenever I have taken New Guineans with me to other parts of their island, they regularly talk about local plants and animals with other New Guineans whom they meet. And they gather potentially useful plants and bring them back to their home villages to try planting them. My experiences with New Guineans are paralleled by those of ethnobiologists studying traditional peoples elsewhere. However, all such peoples either practice at least some food production or are the partly acculturated last remnants of the world's former hunter-gatherer societies. Knowledge of wild species was presumably even more detailed before the rise of food production, when everyone on Earth still depended entirely on wild species for food. The first farmers were heirs to that knowledge, accumulated through tens of thousands of years of nature observation by biologically modern humans living in intimate dependence on the natural world. It therefore seems extremely unlikely that wild species of potential value would have escaped the notice of the first farmers. The other related question is whether ancient hunter-gatherers and farmers similarly put their ethnobiological knowledge to good use in selecting wild plants to gather and eventually to cultivate. One test comes from an archaeological site at the edge of the Euphrates Valley in Syria called Tel Abu Huraira. Between 10,000 and 9,000 BC, the people living there may already have been residing year-round in villages, but they were still hunter-gatherers. Crop cultivation began only in the succeeding millennium. The archaeologists Gordon Hillman, Susan College, and David Harris retrieved large quantities of charred plant remains from the site, probably representing discarded garbage of wild plants gathered elsewhere and brought to the site by its residents. The scientists analyzed over 700 samples, each containing an average of over 500 identifiable seeds belonging to over 70 plant species. It turned out that the villagers were collecting a prodigious variety, 157 species of plants identified by their charred seeds, not to mention other plants that cannot now be identified. Were those naive villagers collecting every type of seed plant that they found, bringing it home, poisoning themselves on most of the species, and nourishing themselves from only a few species? No, they were not so silly. While 157 species sounds like indiscriminate collecting, many more species growing wild in the vicinity were absent from the charred remains. The 157 selected species fall into three categories. Many of them have seeds that are non-poisonous and immediately edible. Others, such as pulses and members of the mustard family, have toxic seeds, but the toxins are easily removed, leaving the seeds edible. A few seeds belong to species traditionally used as sources of dyes or medicine. The many wild species not represented among the 157 selected are ones that would have been useless or harmful to people, including all of the most toxic weed species in the environment. Thus, the hunter-gatherers of Tel Abu Huraira were not wasting time and endangering themselves by collecting wild plants indiscriminately. Instead, they evidently knew the local wild plants as intimately as do modern New Guineans, and they use that knowledge to select and bring home only the most useful available seed plants. But those gathered seeds would have constituted the material for the unconscious first steps of plant domestication. My other example of how ancient peoples apparently used their ethnobiological knowledge to good effect comes from the Jordan Valley in the 9th millennium BC, the period of the earliest crop cultivation there. The valley's first domesticated cereals were barley and amber wheat, which are still among the world's most productive crops today. But, as at Tel Abu Huraira, hundreds of other seed-bearing wild plant species must have grown in the vicinity, and 100 or more of them would have been edible and gathered before the rise of plant domestication. What was it about barley and emmer wheat that caused them to be the first crops? Were those first Jordan Valley farmers botanical ignoramuses who didn't know what they were doing? Or were barley and emmer wheat actually the best of the local wild cereals that they could have selected? Two Israeli scientists, Ofer Bar Yosef and Mordechai Kislev, tackled this question by examining the wild grass species still growing wild in the valley today. Leaving aside species with small or unpalatable seeds, they picked out 23 of the most palatable and largest seeded wild grasses. Not surprisingly, barley and emmer wheat were on that list. But it wasn't true that the 21 other candidates would have been equally useful. Among those 23, barley and emmer wheat proved to be the best by many criteria. Emmer wheat has the biggest seeds, and barley the second biggest. In the wild, barley is one of the four most abundant of the 23 species, while emmer wheat is of medium abundance. Barley has the further advantage that its genetics and morphology permit it to evolve quickly the useful changes in seed dispersal and germination inhibition that we discussed in the preceding chapter. Emmer wheat, however, has compensating virtues. It can be gathered more efficiently than barley, and it is unusual among cereals in that its seeds do not adhere to husks. As for the other 21 species, their drawbacks include smaller seeds, in many cases lower abundance, and in some cases their being perennial rather than annual plants, with the consequence that they would have evolved only slowly under domestication. Thus, the first farmers in the Jordan Valley selected the two very best of the 23 best wild grass species available to them. Of course, the evolutionary changes following cultivation in seed dispersal and germination inhibition would have been unforeseen consequences of what those first farmers were doing. But their initial selection of barley and emmer wheat rather than other cereals to collect, bring home, and cultivate would have been conscious, and based on the easily detected criteria of seed size, palatability, and abundance. This example from the Jordan Valley, like that from Tel Abu Huraira, illustrates that the first farmers and their detailed knowledge of local species to their own benefit. Knowing far more about local plants than all but a handful of modern professional botanists, they would hardly have failed to cultivate any useful wild plant species that was comparably suitable for domestication. We can now examine what local farmers in two parts of the world, New Guinea and the eastern United States, with indigenous but apparently deficient food production systems compared to that of the Fertile Crescent, actually did when more productive crops arrived from elsewhere. If it turned out that such crops did not become adopted for cultural or other reasons, we would be left with a nagging doubt. Despite all our reasoning so far, we would still have to suspect that the local wild flora harbored some ancestor of a potential valuable crop that local farmers failed to exploit because of similar cultural factors. These two examples will also demonstrate in detail a fact critical to history, that indigenous crops from different parts of the globe were not equally productive. New Guinea, the largest island in the world after Greenland, lies just north of Australia and near the equator. Because of its tropical location and great diversity in topography and habitats, New Guinea is rich in both plant and animal species, though less so than continental tropical areas, because it is an island. People have been living in New Guinea for at least 40,000 years, much longer than in the Americas, and slightly longer than anatomically modern peoples have been living in Western Europe. Thus, New Guineans have had ample opportunity to get to know their local flora and fauna. Were they motivated to apply this knowledge to developing food production? I mentioned already that the adoption of food production involved a competition between the food-producing and the hunting-gathering lifestyles. Hunting-gathering is not so rewarding in New Guinea as to remove the motivation to develop food production. In particular, modern New Guinea hunters suffer from the crippling disadvantage of a dearth of wild game. There is no native land animal larger than a 100-pound flightless bird, the cassowary, and a 50-pound kangaroo. Lowland New Guineans on the coast do obtain much fish and shellfish, and some lowlanders in the interior still live today as hunter-gatherers, subsisting especially on wild sago palms. But no peoples still live as hunter-gatherers in the New Guinea highlands. All modern highlanders are instead farmers, who use wild foods only to supplement their diets. When highlanders go into the forest on hunting trips, they take along garden-grown vegetables to feed themselves. If they have the misfortune to run out of those provisions, even they starve to death despite their detailed knowledge of locally available wild foods. Since the hunting-gathering lifestyle is thus non-viable in much of modern New Guinea, it comes as no surprise that all New Guinea highlanders, and most lowlanders today, are settled farmers with sophisticated systems of food production. Extensive, formerly forested areas of the highlands were converted by traditional New Guinea farmers to fenced, drained, intensively managed field systems supporting dense human populations. Archaeological evidence shows that the origins of New Guinea agriculture are ancient, dating to around 7,000 BC. At those early dates, all the land masses surrounding New Guinea were still occupied exclusively by hunter-gatherers. So this ancient agriculture must have developed independently in New Guinea. While unequivocal remains of crops have not been removed from those early fields, they are likely to have included some of the same crops that were being grown in New Guinea at the time of European colonization and that are now known to have been domesticated locally from wild New Guinea ancestors. Foremost among these local domesticates is the modern world's leading crop, sugarcane, of which the annual tonnage produced today nearly equals that of the number two and number three crops combined, wheat and corn. Other crops of undoubted New Guinea origin are a group of bananas known as Australimusa bananas, the nut tree Cinarium indicum, and giant swamp taro, as well as various edible grass stems, roots, and green vegetables. The breadfruit tree and the root crops yams and ordinary taro may also be New Guinean domesticates, although that conclusion remains uncertain because their wild ancestors are not confined to New Guinea but are distributed from New Guinea to Southeast Asia. At present, we lack evidence that could resolve the question whether they were domesticated in Southeast Asia, as traditionally assumed, or independently, or even only in New Guinea. However, it turns out that New Guinea's biota suffered from three severe limitations. First, no cereal crops were domesticated in New Guinea, whereas several vitally important ones were domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, Sahel, and China. In its emphasis instead on root and tree crops, New Guinea carries to an extreme a trend seen in agricultural systems in other wet tropical areas, the Amazon, tropical West Africa, and Southeast Asia, whose farmers also emphasized root crops but did manage to come up with at least two cereals, Asian rice, and a giant-seeded Asian cereal called Job's Tears. A likely reason for the failure of cereal agriculture to arise in New Guinea is a glaring deficiency of the wild starting material. Not one of the world's 56 largest seeded wild grasses is native there. Second, the New Guinea fauna included no domesticable large mammal species whatsoever. The sole domestic animals of modern New Guinea, the pig, the chicken, and dog, arrived from Southeast Asia by way of Indonesia within the last several thousand years. As a result, while New Guinea lowlanders obtain protein from the fish they catch, New Guinea highland farmer populations suffer from severe protein limitation because the staple crops that provide most of their calories, taro and sweet potato, are low in protein. Taro, for example, consists of barely 1% protein, much worse than even white rice, and far below the levels of the Fertile Crescent's wheats and pulses, 8 to 14%, and 20 to 25% protein, respectively. Children in the New Guinea highlands have the swollen bellies characteristic of a high-bulk but protein-deficient diet. New Guineans old and young routinely eat mice, spiders, frogs, and other small animals that peoples elsewhere with access to large domestic animals or large wild game species do not bother to eat. Protein starvation is probably also the ultimate reason why cannibalism was widespread in traditional New Guinea highland societies. Finally, in former times, New Guinea's available root crops were limiting for calories as well as for protein, because they do not grow well at the high elevations where many New Guineans live today. Many centuries ago, however, a new root crop of ultimately South American origin, the sweet potato, reached New Guinea, probably by way of the Philippines, where it had been introduced by Spaniards. Compared with taro and other presumably older New Guinea root crops, the sweet potato can be grown up to higher elevations, grows more quickly, and gives higher yields per acre cultivated and per hour of labor. The result of the sweet potato's arrival was a highland population explosion. That is, even though people had been farming in the New Guinea highlands for many thousands of years before sweet potatoes were introduced, the available local crops had limited them in the population densities they could attain and in the elevations they could occupy. In short, New Guinea offers an instructive contrast to the Fertile Crescent. Like hunter-gatherers of the Fertile Crescent, those of New Guinea did evolve food production independently. However, their indigenous food production was restricted by the local absence of domesticable cereals, pulses, and animals, by the resulting protein deficiency in the highlands, and by limitations of the locally available root crops at high elevations. Yet New Guineans themselves know as much about the wild plants and animals available to them as any peoples on Earth today. They can be expected to have discovered and tested any wild plant species worth domesticating. They are perfectly capable of recognizing useful additions to their crop larder, as is shown by their exuberant adoption of the sweet potato when it arrived. That same lesson is being driven home again in New Guinea today, as those tribes with preferential access to introduced new crops and livestock, or with the cultural willingness to adopt them, expand at the expense of tribes without that access or willingness. Thus, the limits on indigenous food production in New Guinea had nothing to do with New Guinea peoples and everything with the New Guinea biota and environment. Our other example of indigenous agriculture, apparently constrained by the local flora, comes from the eastern United States. Like New Guinea, that area supported independent domestication of local wild plants. However, early developments are much better understood for the eastern United States than for New Guinea. The crops grown by the earliest farmers have been identified, and the dates and crop sequences of local domestication are known. Well before other crops began to arrive from elsewhere, Native Americans settled in the eastern United States river valleys and developed intensified food production based on local crops. Hence, they were in a position to take advantage of the most promising wild plants. Which ones did they actually cultivate? And how did the resulting local crop package compare with the Fertile Crescent's founder package? It turns out that the eastern United States founder crops were four plants domesticated in the period 2500 to 1500 BC, a full 6,000 years after wheat and barley domestication in the Fertile Crescent. A local species of squash provided small containers, as well as yielding edible seeds. The remaining three founders were grown solely for their edible seeds. Sunflower, a daisy relative called sumpweed, and a distant relative of spinach called goosefoot. But four seed crops and a container fall far short of a complete food production package. For 2,000 years, those founder crops served only as minor dietary supplements, while eastern United States Native Americans continued to depend mainly on wild foods, especially wild mammals and water birds, fish, shellfish, and nuts. Farming did not supply a major part of their diet until the period 500 to 200 BC. After three more seed crops, knotweed, maygrass, and little barley, had been brought into cultivation. A modern nutritionist would have applauded those seven eastern U.S. crops. All of them were high in protein, 17 to 32%, compared with 8 to 14% for wheat, 9% for corn, and even lower for barley and white rice. Two of them, sunflower and sumpweed, were also high in oil, 45 to 47%. Sumpweed in particular would have been a nutritionist's ultimate dream, being 32% protein and 45% oil. Why aren't we still eating those dream foods today? Alas, despite their nutritional advantage, most of these eastern U.S. crops suffered from serious disadvantages in other respects. Goosefoot, knotweed, little barley, and maygrass had tiny seeds, with volumes only one-tenth that of wheat and barley seeds. Worse yet, sumpweed is a wind-pollinated relative of ragweed, the notorious hay-fever-causing plant. Like ragweeds, sumpweed's pollen can cause hay fever where the plant occurs in abundant stands. If that doesn't kill your enthusiasm for becoming a sumpweed farmer, be aware that it has a strong odor objectionable to some people and that handling it can cause skin irritation. Mexican crops finally began to reach the eastern United States by trade routes after AD 1. Corn arrived around AD 200, but its role remained very minor for many centuries. Finally, around AD 900, a new variety of corn adapted to North America's short summers appeared, and the arrival of beans around AD 1100 completed Mexico's crop trinity of corn, beans, and squash. Eastern U.S. farming became greatly intensified, and densely populated chiefdoms developed along the Mississippi River and its tributaries. In some areas, the original local domesticates were retained alongside the far more productive Mexican trinity, but in other areas, the trinity replaced them completely. No European ever saw sumpweed growing in Indian gardens because it had disappeared as a crop by the time that European colonization of the Americas began in AD 1492. Among all those ancient eastern U.S. crop specialties, only two, sunflower and eastern squash, have been able to compete with crops domesticated elsewhere and are still grown today. Our modern acorn squashes and summer squashes are derived from those American squashes domesticated thousands of years ago. Thus, like the case of New Guinea, that of the eastern United States is instructive. A priori, the region might have seemed a likely one to support productive indigenous agriculture. It has rich soils, reliable moderate rainfall, and a suitable climate that sustains bountiful agriculture today. The flora is a species-rich one that includes productive wild nut trees, oak and hickory. Local Native Americans did develop an agriculture based on local domesticates, did thereby support themselves in villages, and even developed a cultural florescence. The Hopewell culture centered on what is today Ohio, around 200 BC to 400 AD. They were thus in a position for several thousand years to exploit as potential crops the most useful available wild plants, whatever those should be. Nevertheless, the Hopewell florescence sprang up nearly 9,000 years after the rise of village living in the Fertile Crescent. Still, it was not until after AD 900 that the assembly of the Mexican crop trinity triggered a larger population boom, the so-called Mississippian florescence, which produced the largest towns and most complex societies achieved by Native Americans north of Mexico. But that boom came much too late to prepare Native Americans of the United States for the impending disaster of European colonization. Food production based on eastern U.S. crops alone had been insufficient to trigger the boom, for reasons that are easy to specify. The area's available wild cereals were not nearly as useful as wheat and barley. Native Americans of the eastern United States domesticated no locally available wild pulse, no fiber crop, no fruit or nut tree. They had no domesticated animals at all except for dogs, which were probably domesticated elsewhere in the Americas. It's also clear that Native Americans of the eastern United States were not overlooking potential major crops among the wild species around them. Even 20th century plant breeders, armed with all the power of modern science, have had little success in exploiting North American wild plants. Yes, we have now domesticated pecans as a nut tree and blueberries as a fruit, and we have improved some Eurasian fruit crops, apples, plums, grapes, raspberries, blackberries, strawberries, by hybridizing them with North American wild relatives. However, those few successes have changed our food habits far less than Mexican corn changed food habits of Native Americans in the eastern United States after AD 900. The farmers most knowledgeable about eastern U.S. domesticates, the region's Native Americans themselves, passed judgment on them by discarding or de-emphasizing them when the Mexican Trinity arrived. That outcome also demonstrates that Native Americans were not constrained by cultural conservatism and were quite able to appreciate a good plant when they saw it. Thus, as in New Guinea, the limitations on indigenous food production in the eastern United States were not due to Native American peoples themselves, but instead depended entirely on the American biota and environment. We have now considered examples of three contrasting areas, in all of which food production did arise indigenously. The Fertile Crescent lies at one extreme. New Guinea and the eastern United States lie at the opposite extreme. Peoples of the Fertile Crescent domesticated local plants much earlier. They domesticated far more species, domesticated far more productive or valuable species, domesticated a much wider range of types of crops, developed intensified food production, and dense human populations more rapidly. And as a result, entered the modern world with more advanced technology, more complex political organization, and more epidemic diseases with which to infect other peoples. We found that these differences between the Fertile Crescent, New Guinea, and the eastern United States followed straightforwardly from the differing suites of wild plant and animal species available for domestication, not from limitations of the peoples themselves. When more productive crops arrived from elsewhere, the sweet potato in New Guinea, the Mexican Trinity in the eastern United States, local peoples promptly took advantage of them, intensified food production, and increased greatly in population. By extension, I suggest that areas of the globe where food production never developed indigenously at all, California, Australia, the Argentine Pampas, Western Europe, and so on, may have offered even less in the way of wild plants and animals suitable for domestication than did New Guinea and the eastern United States, where at least a limited food production did arise. Indeed, Mark Blumler's worldwide survey of locally available large-seeded wild grasses mentioned in this chapter, and the worldwide survey of locally available big mammals to be presented in the next chapter, agree in showing that all those areas of non-existent or limited indigenous food production were deficient in wild ancestors of domesticable livestock and cereals. Recall that the rise of food production involved a competition between food production and hunting-gathering. One might therefore wonder whether all these cases of slow or non-existent rise of food production might instead have been due to an exceptional local richness of resources to be hunted and gathered, rather than to an exceptional availability of species suitable for domestication. In fact, most areas where indigenous food production arose late or not at all offered exceptionally poor rather than rich resources to hunter-gatherers, because most large mammals of Australia and the Americas, but not of Eurasia and Africa, had become extinct toward the end of the Ice Ages. Food production would have faced even less competition from hunting-gathering in these areas than it did in the Fertile Crescent. Hence, these local failures or limitations of food production cannot be attributed to competition from bountiful hunting opportunities. Lest these conclusions be misinterpreted, we should end this chapter with caveats against exaggerating two points: people's readiness to accept better crops and livestock, and the constraints imposed by locally available wild plants and animals. Neither that readiness nor those constraints are absolute. We've already discussed many examples of local peoples adopting more productive crops domesticated elsewhere. Our broad conclusion is that people can recognize useful plants, would therefore have probably recognized better local ones suitable for domestication if any had existed, and aren't barred from doing so by cultural conservatism or taboos. But a big qualifier must be added to this sentence: in the long run and over large areas. Anyone knowledgeable about human societies can cite innumerable examples of societies that refused crops, livestock, and other innovations that would have been productive. Naturally, I don't subscribe to the obvious fallacy that every society promptly adopts every innovation that would be useful for it. The fact is that over entire continents and other large areas containing hundreds of competing societies, some societies will be more open to innovation, and some will be more resistant. The ones that do adopt new crops, livestock, or technology may thereby be enabled to nourish themselves better and to outbreed, displace, conquer, or kill off societies resisting innovation. That's an important phenomenon whose manifestations extend far beyond the adoption of new crops, and to which we shall return in Chapter 13. Our other caveat concerns the limits that locally available wild species set on the rise of food production. I'm not saying that food production could never, in any amount of time, have arisen in all those areas where it actually had not arisen indigenously by modern times. Europeans today, who note that Aboriginal Australians entered the modern world as Stone Age hunter-gatherers, often assume that the Aborigines would have gone on that way forever. To appreciate the fallacy, consider a visitor from outer space who dropped in on Earth in the year 3000 BC. The spaceling would have observed no food production in the eastern United States, because food production did not begin there until around 2500 BC. Had the visitor of 3000 BC drawn the conclusion that limitations posed by the wild plants and animals of the eastern United States foreclosed food production there forever, events of the subsequent millennium would have proved the visitor wrong. Even a visitor to the Fertile Crescent in 9500 BC rather than in 8500 BC could have been misled into supposing the Fertile Crescent permanently unsuitable for food production. That is, my thesis is not that California, Australia, Western Europe, and all the other areas without indigenous food production were devoid of domesticable species and would have continued to be occupied just by hunter-gatherers indefinitely if foreign domesticates or peoples had not arrived. Instead, I note that regions differed greatly in their available pool of domesticable species, that they varied correspondingly in the date when local food production arose, and that food production had not yet arisen independently in some fertile regions as of modern times. Australia, supposedly the most backward continent, illustrates this point well. In southeastern Australia, the well-watered part of the continent most suitable for food production, Aboriginal societies in recent millennia appear to have been evolving on a trajectory that would eventually have led to indigenous food production. They had already built winter villages. They had begun to manage their environment intensively for fish production by building fish traps, nets, and even long canals. Had Europeans not colonized Australia in 1788 and aborted that independent trajectory, Aboriginal Australians might, within a few thousand years, have become food producers, tending ponds of domesticated fish, and growing domesticated Australian yams and small-seeded grasses. In that light, we can now answer the question implicit in the title of this chapter. I asked whether the reason for the failure of North American Indians to domesticate North American apples lay with the Indians or with the apples. I'm not thereby implying that apples could never have been domesticated in North America. Recall that apples were historically among the most difficult fruit trees to cultivate and among the last major ones to be domesticated in Eurasia, because their propagation requires the difficult technique of grafting. There is no evidence for large-scale cultivation of apples even in the Fertile Crescent, and in Europe until classical Greek times, 8,000 years after the rise of Eurasian food production began. If Native Americans had proceeded at the same rate in inventing or acquiring grafting techniques, they too would eventually have domesticated apples, around the year AD 5500, some 8,000 years after the rise of domestication in North America, around 2500 BC. Thus, the reason for the failure of Native Americans to domesticate North American apples by the time Europeans arrived lay neither with the people nor with the apples. As far as biological prerequisites for apple domestication were concerned, North American Indian farmers were like Eurasian farmers, and North American wild apples were like Eurasian wild apples. Indeed, some of the supermarket apple varieties now being munched by readers of this chapter have been developed recently by crossing Eurasian apples with wild North American apples. Instead, the reason Native Americans did not domesticate apples lay with the entire suite of wild plant and animal species available to Native Americans. That suite's modest potential for domestication was responsible for the late start of food production in North America.